Hi there, I'm Marianne Lozano, president of the Broadleaf Board of Directors and the conference chair for the 9th Annual Broadleaf Writers Conference. This year, our conference will be held Saturday and Sunday, September 21st and 22nd at the Decatur Library in Decatur, Georgia. The 9th Annual Broadleaf Writers Conference offers 2 days of panels, workshops, one-on-one pitch and mentoring sessions, a first pages critique, opportunities to meet and chat with our guest authors and literary agents, and plenty of time to spend with a community of fellow writers in attendance. We strive to attract top-level speakers, both with a track record of success in the industry, as well as those just beginning their careers, with the capacity and desire to help writers on their path to publication. This year, we're thrilled to be headlined by New York Times bestselling author Mary Kay Andrews. Registration for the 9th Annual Broadleaf Writers Conference opens May 1st, so be sure to save the date. To learn more about our conference, I hope you'll visit our website at broadleafwriters.com. See you this fall.
Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of Right Now, a podcast on the craft and business of writing presented to you by Broadleaf Writers Association based in Atlanta, Georgia. I'm your host, Zachary Steele, and on today's episode, I'm pleased to welcome the Bram Stoker nominated author of In the Valley of the Sun, The Boatman's Daughter, and The Hollow Kind, Andy Davidson, for a discussion on creating characters the reader won't forget. Hey, Andy, how are you doing today?
Pretty good, Zach. How are you?
I'm doing well, staying busy with the writing side of things, which I understand that you must be as well.
Right. Yeah, that is a never-ending source of busy for me lately.
Yeah, and you're working on your next book right now.
Yeah, I've got my next book is supposedly coming out in 2025, which seems like a long way away and also seems like it's right around the corner in terms of how much I've still got to do.
it only ever seems like a long way away after all the work's done and you're waiting for it to come out. Right. Otherwise, everything feels too fast.
Yeah, which is funny because both parts of that process can be agony. So the writing of the book is agony, and then the waiting on the book to come out is agony. So which is the sweeter agony?
Yeah, I think I'll take the sweeter agony of waiting for it to come out. Writing and editing can be a slog.
Yeah, Crystal and I were talking about, we got Lent coming up, and she was talking about what she was thinking about giving up for Lent, and I said, well, can I give up novel writing for Lent?
How about we just give up imposter syndrome? There we go. Right.
That's a good thing.
All right, well, In terms of thinking about constructing stories, obviously one of the more vital pieces of a story are the characters that are in it. It's not really much of a story if you don't have the people. So what I wanted to run through with you is the your process on creating characters and how we might be able to help other writers in their process of building characters that readers will remember that have this sort of depth and emotional connection that resonate with readers. And as with writing, there's no better place to start than the beginning, and the beginning of characters will just be literally creating them. And I wanted to know, with you, do you do the majority of your work with characters before writing the draft, or do you allow them to emerge through the process of writing and editing?
It's kind of an even split. In an ideal situation, it's an even split. Sometimes it gets heavier on the back end because the pre-work that I do in character development is always sort of associated with the big questions of who are these characters, what do they want, and how do those decisions, choices, actions sort of lead to events in the plot, story events, right?
Right.
And then, so character, plot, and then the world itself, the setting, is another thing that I do kind of on the front end. But it's not until you get into the writing part of the whole process for me that characters kind of start to do weird things. They start to evolve, they start to change, they start to be surprising in ways you didn't expect them to be. one of the key things for me with characters and figuring out who a character is listening to the way they talk, their voice. And that part does not come in until drafting for me, because I don't do, I just have this sort of like student's aversion to writing exercises. I won't sit down and write something unless I know it's going to be used for the book. Of course it might get thrown out later, but so I don't do like conversations or dialogues between characters until they're actually in the book talking to each other, because I think that's when they start to say things that are really interesting, is when they're in the pressure cooker of the story. And so character emerges that way, kind of naturally. How do they talk? What's the rhythm of speaking? And that's really important for me, because it also tends to dictate the rhythm and tone of a scene. It can dictate the voice of my own writing in a book. So drafting is a big part of it. And I would say that edits do change decisions that a character might make, which in turn changes like a story beat, you know.
Right.
And that can have a ripple effect through various story elements, depending on how big of a change or how small of a change. But yeah, it seems like the drafting part is where the characters truly sort of take on their true selves. Because I, as a writer, I can sit down and do in the pre-writing stage with my planning, which is always the most fun for me. I enjoy the sort of quote pre-production part of the process way more than the drafting, because the drafting is just hard.
Yeah.
It never seems to get easier. I'm finding that it just stays hard and gets harder. But you know, early on, like there's a few techniques I might do. Like if I have a character, say like, I think I did this with my third book, The Hollowkind. So I have a character like Nelly, who's the main character of that book. I might try a technique that Robert McKee recommends in one of his books, where he creates these character maps that show multi-dimensional aspects of a character. So like you figure, well, this character is kind and generous, but this character can also be cruel and selfish. Mm-hmm. And so you find these dimensions that are kind of binary opposites. And the more of those you have, the richer your character is. And when they get into the story, the actual writing of the book, and you're in there with them, those dimensions start to kind of change, they start to shift, or they start to really inform what they say and why they say it. So, yeah.
Yeah. So, I say this without knowing whether or not you are an outliner or not, but it the process that you're describing is very much with the characters specifically, is, you know, you have your foundation, but you're pantsing your way through it. You're just kind of letting them guide you through the story, guide you through their journey, and tell you who they are.
I have outlined it in the past. I will say that
I just meant specific to the characters in the story and where they go. You kind of let them go where they're going to go.
And they change. They change the story. They change the outline. So
And how often do you have characters appear that you hadn't planned on having, or had characters that you realized needed to vanish more quickly than you had anticipated?
Not so much, not very often. I think that the major characters are usually there from the beginning. There might be a character who's sort of a less major character. I wouldn't call them a minor character, but I'm thinking about in my first book, In the Valley of the Sun, I have a character that originally was just sort of a walk-on foil for the main character, this character Calhoun, who's a bartender, is romantically interested in Annabelle, one of the major characters in the book, and originally he was just kind of there as this suitor that she was not terribly interested in, but in small town life sometimes we just sort of take what we can get, and that was sort of his purpose in the narrative, was to be whatever she could get. And when I was writing the book, I don't remember when it happened. It might have been in the second or third draft, because that book went through many, many drafts. Calhoun took on a bigger part, and I started to see him from the inside out and sort of look at Annabelle through his eyes. And suddenly he seemed like a much more sympathetic character. He had this whole life. He had his own desires, hopes, and dreams, and ultimately he became a stronger part of the narrative and followed through most of the book until the very end, where something terrible happens to him. And you know, that ultimately was much more enriching to the story than just having him on in the book for a few chapters, you know.
Well, as you're developing these characters, how much of who they are comes from your life, whether it's people that you have encountered or people watching that that you may have done.
I love to people watch. I will say that.
Yeah, it's we are professional stalkers.
Yeah, it's absolutely the best thing in the world to do, to go to a public place and have no agenda other than observing people's behavior. Because I think like the best stuff to come out of people watching is when you see people doing the things that they don't want other people to see them do, right? Whether it's people having an argument, or whether it's someone picking their nose, or whether it's, just the most mundane things, or there can be like really interesting, odd things that people do too. So yeah, I love to do that. I will say that for me, it's kind of like, it's not about finding like a weird tick or a thing that someone does, but it's about kind of watching how they behave, and how they interact with other people. So, when I think about some of the people that I've based characters on, or kind of little aspects of character have found their way into my books. I won't say that characters are based whole cloth on any one person. It's questions like, are they confrontational in one setting, and are they pleasant in another? You know, how do they talk to different kinds of people? How do people contradict themselves? That's a really interesting question for me. And so, yeah, like those are the things I want to look for, is like, is there something I can observe or see here that is interesting in that way? So it's kind of thinking holistically too, right, about people. So like in the question of like, is it real life? It's like, well, I mean, for me, I think that there are tricks, and there are traits, and there are observable behaviors that people have that you can grab and stick in a book if they're interesting, like the way someone holds a cigarette lighter and opens it and shuts it and opens it and shuts it, compulsive behaviors. Or those are kind of small things, but for me, it's, I think most of the time what I draw from real life is characters become these sort of composites of a lot of different people, not just based on one person. So
Yeah, people watching is such a great study in the show versus tell concept, because you had mentioned that people like you can observe things that maybe people don't want others to actually see, but it amazes me oftentimes how much people will do and say out in public, not
yeah.
really knowing or thinking about the fact that somebody may be watching or listening.
That's true.
I'm
That's
yeah, I mean,
true.
I remember being in a cafe once and hearing a conversation of a first date of people who met on Twitter, and it wasn't the oddity of that, because that's not even odd anymore, but it was the way they spoke to one another, because I wasn't even facing them, so all I had was the sound and just the cadence of the voice. You could hear the nerves. I could almost hear the shifting of hands and stuff like that. But yeah, it's a great way to study how to show what a character is feeling in a given moment. So I'm a big fan of people watching.
Yeah, it's interesting too to watch how people relate to objects around them, you know, like not just to other people, but yeah, most people these days, the only object you really see them relating to in public anymore is their phone. So that can be kind of depressing and sad. But But sometimes you do get someone who, you know, holds a thing a certain way or tosses a thing in their hand or smokes a cigarette a certain way, some thing you've never seen before, which is always fun.
Yeah, I agree. So one of the other aspects of creating a character is motivation, obviously one of the more critical aspects of creating a character. And I heard it put this way once, and it has stuck. It's the unconscious misbelief, or what the character believes incorrectly about themselves, versus the conscious desire, which is what they believe they need. So it's the whole want versus need for the character. But I would love to hear your thoughts on playing with the motivations and the wants and needs of the characters that you create.
Yeah, sure. Like I like that phrase, misbelief. I haven't heard that before. Like
it just stuck with me as soon as I heard it, and I have taken it and used it, because it really helped me at a particular time when I needed it, you know, understand what it was my characters are supposed to be battling within, and tie it all into their motivation and what draws them forward versus what the story is drawing them toward.
Yeah. I think of the two warring factors in a character for me are conscious and unconscious, but it's the desire. So you mentioned the conscious desire. I think I tend to just use the phrase unconscious desire as the sort of the opposite of that. So like,
right.
What a character thinks they want, that they are pursuing, which is driving the story, versus what emerges over the course of the story that maybe they didn't even know they needed. And ideally, in that situation, I think the way you get the biggest impact in your story is if the unconscious desire is almost the opposite of the conscious desire. So
right.
They achieve something almost completely opposite of what they set out to achieve. And that's where real growth, I think, comes in as a character. So like, thinking like, this is easy to do in movies more than it is in books, but like, I'm thinking about like Mattie Ross in True Grit. So you know from the very beginning in that novel that what she wants is to hire a marshal to avenge the death of her father and bring his murderer to justice or to death. And through the course of the novel, she pursues that with gusto. But what is kind of gradually revealed, I think unconsciously, even on her part, and she's a character and a narrator that almost is so intelligent and so whip smart that like she leaves very little about herself to the unconscious. She's very aware of herself. But by the end of that book, what you have is you have this relationship that's grown between her and Cogburn, the marshal. So to the point that he's almost become a substitute father in the narrative. And he has kind of, if not replaced what she's lost, there's perhaps some type of healing or moving on from the grief a little bit, in the fact that he saves her life. And so there's this kind of, you know, she wants to set out to kill the man that killed her father, but what she ultimately gains is sort of a new father in the end. I was thinking about this question in terms of other media, like in movies, and it's just, sometimes it's like, it's fun to think about it in terms of like, it doesn't always happen. I mean, even in the best movies that we know and love, sometimes our heroes don't change, they don't grow, or they don't have some kind of conscious versus unconscious desire at war within themselves. Like, it's almost like I'm thinking like in Raiders of the Lost Ark, you've got Indiana Jones, the adventurer, who wants to, like, he's pursuing the Ark, and he's it's a race against evil and all of that, but that seems to be motivation enough. I don't think at the end of that, he has achieved any unconscious desire.
I think if I were to, I'm sorry, I almost went to an Arrested Development line. I think if I were to analyze that in my vision, I would say that he saw the Ark as a pure item in the beginning, and right. that item needed to be preserved. But as he evolved through the story, though he didn't change, his perspective on it did, in that he came to understand that it was something that needed to be tucked away and revered, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know. Well, I'm throwing darts here.
No, I would agree with that. And like, I think it's much more pronounced in the second film, which is often the film people point to as being the one that they don't like. At least it was until the last couple of films. But
if you think people don't like something enough, just wait, there'll be another one.
Right. Yeah, but like Temple of Doom, he's got this articulated conscious desire of fortune and glory.
Mm-hmm.
And what he ultimately achieves in the end is an ideal, which is the restoration of children, you know, justice. It's justice brought back to this small village. And he gives up his own fortune and glory for the fortune and glory of the village. And so it is this sort of conscious and unconscious thing that takes shape over the course of the narrative.
Mm-hmm.
And he insists pretty well through most of the film that he's after fortune and glory, and he's not even aware of it. And so I think that's when it's really great, is when a character is not aware of the thing they need to fix themselves.
Right. The one element of that I actually love in that movie, because I'm a big proponent of this in my own writing, is you go from Indiana Jones as a solitary person to this found family of Short mm-hmm. Round, and right now I'm completely blanking on her character's name, but
Lee Scott. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was another really cool thing that evolved in that particular one.
Mm-hmm. And the end of that sort of reinforces that with the restoration of the families in the village with their children that
mm-hmm.
he frees. Yeah. So it's nice that way.
Yeah.
Everything bends toward that unconscious desire.
Yep. So every protagonist has to have an antagonist. And I think sometimes it's misrepresented that the antagonist always has to be an external force that is putting pressure on our protagonist. But how much importance do you place on creating the antagonist within, whether that be anything from doubt to a literal voice within, or even a demon, you know, depending on which direction you want to go?
Yeah, well, I think like this is where that word misbelief comes back in for me, is like you have to have doubt. You have to have a certain amount of self-doubt in characters for them to overcome that, I think. And this is like, you know, I mean, that's just me saying that. You don't have to have that. Anybody could argue with me the opposite.
Right.
This is my own personal like preferences. What kind of characters do I want to read about? And I certainly don't want to read about perfect characters. I don't want to read about Jack Reacher, who seems to never need anything more than to solve someone else's problems. But for me, a character that has some sort of internal sense of self that is threatened by their own self-doubt, I think that's a really strong and fertile place for connecting with your reader emotionally. Because I think it's something that we all kind of understand and need to overcome. So there is that literal voice that we can work in as writers, right? Like we can have voices in a character's head, or we can have that doubt articulated in a way. In my first book, Annabelle Gaskin, one of the protagonists in that book, she hears the voice of her long dead mother, you know, repeatedly in her head, which kind of picks at her and cajoles her and pushes that idea of you're less than, which she's always fighting against. And I think that's probably true in my last book as well. I think Nellie hears the voice of her husband, who's just constantly undermining her and cutting her down. And it's something she fights with and wrestles with in her consciousness. But, you know, ultimately her husband shows up in the form of a monster that is created by a much worse monster that lives in the woods. And so it's kind of like she has to really fight those monsters as well. So that's, I love that, like the way that you can take the unconscious or the figurative and kind of translate it to a literal monster in horror. That's one of my favorite things.
It's pretty much the universal law of attraction in work, right? If you manifest it in your life.
Right.
Right. Well, we'll shift to the external antagonist now, because I would love to hear your thoughts on whether we're talking about the antagonist slash villain that you are creating, or whether it is a movie you're watching or a show you're watching. What is it that you look for in a villain?
I think it's a lot of times the same things that you look for in a hero or in a protagonist. You want dimensionality. You want a villain that exhibits not one or even two notes, but maybe four or six notes. You know, Robert McKee sort of famously talked about Walter White in Breaking Bad as being kind of the ultimate multi-dimensional character in television, as he did one of his charts, you know, and showed all of the different labels you can give to the dimensions of Walter's character. And that's a running question throughout the show, is Walter the villain, is Walter the hero? And you know, he's a family man, but he's also a sociopath. He's gentle, but he's also violent. He's apologetic, but he's also never apologetic. So all of these things, these dimensions that kind of define who he is, make him a very compelling character, whether he's the hero or the villain. And I think he, by the end of the series, is clearly the villain. And so I guess, yeah, like it's kind of in a way a boring answer, but I think you sort of look for the same thing you do in a hero, which is essentially just dimensionality and depth. You don't want a sort of mustache twirling villain, right? You want someone
right.
That we can feel something for.
I feel like you always have to have sort of an air of confliction with a villain. Like, you know, if we go big on this one and think of somebody like Darth Vader, you know, from a constructed standpoint, and I'm not going to debate whether or not the prequels were good or whatever, but you know, you have a character here who you see is evil. He sees darkness and angry, but the more you learn about his backstory, the more you learn about what he was, the more empathetic that you become with that particular villain. And it creates a very fascinating character that stands, you know, that people remember, that carries on. And
I was just going to say, on the Vader thing, one of my favorite moments is it's in the third film, after Luke is brought to him and he has this conversation with him and says, "I've accepted the truth that you were once my father," and says the name Anakin. And Vader says, "That name no longer has any meaning for me. I'm going to take you before the Emperor and he's your master now." And they shuffle Luke off, and Luke has just said, "My father then is truly dead." And it's just one of my favorite moments, where we get this moment where the camera stays on Vader for a second. And it's like there's this great mystery of, what is he thinking? What's going on in his head? And you know, it's nothing too simple
because of the
scene. And so, I mean, he's vulnerable in that moment. And so I think vulnerability is one of the keys with villains, is they can't be invulnerable to emotions.
And kind of segueing from there and to that moment, that's actually one of my favorites as well. You know, just the, you can't see the man's face, but you can see it. You know, you know what he's thinking. But you know, it's a moment where we as viewers, in that case, can empathize with what he may be struggling with in that moment about this, this desire. Do I save my son or do I follow my master, you know, kind of thing. And creating empathy is vital to connecting the reader to your character. Do you look for points in the story to try to create that connection, or is this something that just evolves as you work your way through draft and edits?
You know, that's a good question. I think sometimes for me, those things emerge in the later drafts. Sometimes I may have it going in that I know there's this part of the character's backstory or history that informs who they are, and you can't just drop that in if it's something that you want the reader to be empathetic for, because you've got to kind of figure out where to put it. Where does it have the impact you want it to have emotionally? You know, you don't want to let your reader know that this character was abused by his father right after this character drowns a sack of puppies or something, you know, so you've got to like find the right spot to put it in and balance it. So it's palatable for the reader. And usually that's sort of in relationships to other characters. Like, what do other characters bring out in the antagonist that makes them vulnerable in that moment? I don't know that that those are always in my mind when I'm writing the book, but I think certainly in subsequent drafts I go looking for it. Mm-hmm. Places to drop those in, those moments.
Yeah. Well, we're coming close to our end of our time here, but speaking of the end, how often do your characters surprise you as you get to the end of the story, or how often might they die or survive unexpectedly?
By the end of the story, I will say that I hope they're not surprising me, because if they're surprising me at the end, that means that I've probably got to rewrite something 300 pages back, you know,
right.
And subsequently, like for the next 300 pages, comb through there looking for things that don't contradict the surprise, or that the surprise doesn't contradict. But I do like it in the early parts of drafting a book when characters do things unexpectedly, because there's still time to shape the narrative. And I've struggled with that. I've struggled to get a narrative off the ground because a character will keep changing paths and changing directions, and I don't expect what they're going to do, and they do it. Sometimes what they do is the right thing for the story and it just keeps the story moving. Sometimes they'll do something and I have to kind of back up and wait a day or two and say, okay, did I just want that character to do that thing because I thought maybe unconsciously it would be fun and cool? And is that really the right thing that the story needs? And so there is that kind of mental gymnastics of shaping something as you go. But I will say I am always happy when a character makes it out alive that I didn't think was going to. That's always a fun thing, right? Because by the end of the story, you kind of want to kill off somebody so that there's some sort of emotion. Emotional impact on the reader. And if you are able to save everyone and still have that emotional impact, that's always a nice thing.
Yeah.
But with great joy has to come great heartbreak, right? So
it's true. It's true. I guess one thing that I want to reinforce for those who are listening is, and for those who are trying to figure this aspect of writing out, it says everything that we've talked about is just from the writer's focus as they work through a draft. But whether you're unpublished and working with beta readers and critique groups and other readers that you may have, or whether you're actually working with an agent or editor, this is a group thing. You know, you're a lot of these things are shaped by additional input, certainly from the standpoint of where you're at. You're getting a lot of feedback from editors that are helping to shape anything that you may have not gotten exactly right, or something that needed more information.
Yeah. Yeah, my editor that I work with on I've worked with now for two books going into the third is she's a great editor and she's very insightful. You know, she asks hard questions and sometimes when I get my manuscripts back from her, I look at her notes and I'm like, oh Jesus, no. Because this is gonna be hard. Why does it have to be so hard? But they're always great comments. And you're right, you're absolutely right. This becomes a collaborative enterprise once it gets past that first draft.
It definitely does. I know the book I have coming out, when I turned it in, I was feeling very, very good about it. And the first editor's letter that I got back quickly relieved me of that. Because I had to go back and work a few sections in one character that were having some motivation problems. So in the end, I owe my editor for helping me get that character in that story where it needed to get. So it's always important to seek outside counsel wisely, of course,
Absolutely.
or when you're working with a publisher, you know,
And
to take that feedback and to actually hear the words that are spoken.
it's good not to resist it too, because unless it's terrible feedback, that can happen. But
Yes.
generally, if it's good feedback, you know it's good feedback, because if it's the really hard thing to do, that means it's probably great feedback. And don't resist it. Just like give it some time, take a deep breath and roll up the sleeves and do the work, and the book will always be better for it.
One thing that I say often to writers is you, in those moments, you have to look past the hurt and hear the words, because if they are spoken, you know, with a true intent of trying to help make it a better book, then there could be some validity to it.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, Andy, I've enjoyed it and could certainly do this for hours on end, but I appreciate you making the time to talk some characters.
Happy to. Thanks, Zach.
All right. Well, I wish you all the best with your writing and hope to talk to you soon.
All right.
All right. Thanks.